Before we start, with the subject of equality and the annihilation of ego, that is our chapter for the day, I have to make an important announcement on the mother's behalf. We have seen that at times mother acts without waiting for human conditions to be ready. We have also seen on number of occasions when she does not act except in response to the human call. I was reminded of this some 2 days ago when I had to put before her a letter by a visitor, a very young man, bright. He wrote that he is very much captured by the idea and the spirit of Orwell. He is thrilled by it. But then he had a question. He said, for a new creation that is taking shape in Orwell, are not old forms of salutation and greeting, like the folding of palms in India or shake hands as in the West, are they not a bit out of place? Would it not be fitting if people who live in Orwell, who belong to Orwell, have their own mode of salutation? When he gave the letter to me, I was inclined to take it as a joke. But somehow, something felt that there is something serious behind the whole thing. All the same, I kept the letter in my tray, disposing of what I thought to be more important matters concerning day-to-day life of inmates, Orwellians. And it was only day before yesterday that I took the letter to mother and spoke to her about it. She first laughed, then she became serious. She went into meditation. And after a while, she looked at me and said, many things are coming. But then she wouldn't speak. I asked her, for instance, what is coming? I asked mother. She said, bring the paper. So I looked at Champaklal. He gave the writing material, and with a firm hand she wrote, three alternatives, modes of salutation to be operative from today, 1st of November 1972. For those who like to use them, those who stay in Orwell, those who want to belong to Orwell, those who breathe the spirit of Orwell. And the three modes of salutation, yeah, I'm going to leave this original paper here so that you could frame and keep it, because it is intended for Orwell and this is the heart of Orwell. She has written 30.10.7.2. First is in French. Au service de la vérité. Or, at the service of truth. Or, simply, truth. So these are the three modes of greeting each other. Au service de la vérité, or at the service of truth, truth. Mind you, it is not compulsory. It is left to the choice of people. Instead of good morning, bonjour, how do you do, and all these hackneyed expressions which have lost their life, here are meaningful greetings, forms of greeting. I wrote out an explanation the next day and read it to mother, and she approved of it. The substance is, she has given a dynamic content to the form of salutation. By saying any of these, I affirm my consecration, my dedication to truth. And this constant affirmation in word confirms in my consciousness this consecration. Second, when I meet another and use this greeting, it is a reminder to him and to myself that our relations are based upon truth. The basis of our meeting is truth. With this understanding, there is very little room left for the old movements of ignorance, falsehood, and egoism. Each one, when he meets the other, reminds oneself and the other person that we live for the truth, we move towards the truth. So this has an individual aspect of self-confirmation in dedication, collective aspect in spreading on a collective scale this basis of truth. I light up the flame of truth in myself, and where it is dormant, if it be dormant, I awaken it with the power of the conscious word. Truth in thought, truth in speech, towards truth we move. This is the message that I have the privilege of communicating to you all here, and through you all, to all who are staying in Auroville. Cyril, may I give this to you? This is the original. Second, it is not a message. I have not been asked to communicate it. But I felt when it happened and when I wrote about it that I should share it with you. I made it a point that anything that takes place when I go to Mother in between our meetings here, if it has some relevance for your endeavor of building up a new consciousness, I should mention it here. Well, it is like this. All of us have defects. All have weaknesses. It is only those who live enveloped in ignorance that are not prepared to admit that they have defects. For them, the defects are always in others. However, nature has her own way of teaching individuals, men and women, to recognize that there are defects in them, by shocks, by incidents, by failures in life. Each one is forced to recognize his own, their own lacunae in his nature. But once one turns to the life of the spirit or yoga, this is the first thing that happens. All the defects that are there are projected before the mind. If one is sincere in facing them, one is staggered at the enormity of the legacy of defects that one carries. Is there a way out at all? Is it possible to get rid of these? Times without number, I have been subject to moments of despair and depression when I have come to realize the extent or the range of these weaknesses, mental, psychological, emotional, that show themselves at critical occasions, in difficult situations, most unexpected. I have tried on my own to get over them, to discard them, keeping in mind Sri Aurobindo's injunction that it will not do to occupy oneself too much with one's defects. It shall not be allowed to become an obsession. What I cannot do, I have been fortunately circumstanced to place before Mother. And she apparently makes light of it, but does what is to be done. With this background that I have, when friends come to me confessing their difficulties, defects of nature, it is but natural that I encourage them to expose the whole thing to the Mother's light. And it was one such case, concerns a gifted person, very gifted. She was always aware of a particular defect of sadism, of something in her which is hostile even to God, hostile to values of God. But in the outer life, in the outside world, one can very well cover up these things. But here, it became suffocating to her when these things surged up and she did not know what to do. She looked desperate, her face was tense, and she said she must be some kind of incarnation of the devil. I took it to mother. Mother heard it very patiently. She was moved. She said, "Can she pray?" she asked. Then I said, "Certainly she can pray." Then she said she must pray to Sri Aurobindo or to the Divine. Praying to him to make her worthy of him. She added, perhaps it would be best if she could contact her psychic being, but that would be impossible in the present circumstances. So she wrote out a prayer, she concentrated, she went into a trance. And when she came out, she wrote out a prayer. She first in French and then in English. "Lord of mercy, make me worthy of thy grace." She said, "I have done something. Let her use this prayer." And you will be amazed to know that the very afternoon when the person met me, she had been completely relaxed, smiling, looking beautiful. With tears in her eyes, she said, "Did you speak to mother today?" I said, "Yes." "What time?" "The time tally." Suddenly at that time, she said, she felt a warm glow around her face. There was a spurt of love, which was something unusual, and she felt completely relaxed. This is the prayer. One who is faced with the stark reality of his own defects, which refuse to be dissolved, is a prayer to the Lord of Mercy, Seigneur de Bonté, to make me worthy of thy grace. Now, to go back to the subject of our meeting, we have come to a point where we are agreed that the only way to surrender, to submit ourselves to the Supreme Will, to let our human consciousness be taken up in the Divine Consciousness, is through a complete self-consecration. Consecration, even in our day-to-day life, consecration in works, it is an entire consecration. This self-consecration proceeds through three well-defined stages. First, we decide to consecrate ourselves. We have a will to consecrate ourselves in every detail of our life. Whether we immediately succeed in translating this will into practice or not is another matter. But when we start the work, when we pause in the work, when we end the work, we have this affirmation of the will for consecration. By this constant affirmation of the will, we develop later a need in our nature to consecrate. We may do the work, but we will not have the joy and the happiness of the work, the satisfaction of the work, unless it is consecrated. So this stage of feeling the need of consecration is the second. The third is when it develops into a natural habit. One doesn't have to will anymore. One doesn't have to be reminded anymore by the need in the being. One spontaneously consecrates. This is the first movement towards surrender. Second, one develops a complete equality. How to develop this sense of equality? First, when one works, one should give up the desire for the fruit of works. Naturally, when work is done, the fruit is bound to come. But whether it corresponds to what we expect or does not, it should be left to the will of him to whom you consecrate. The Gita has declared that you have a right to for action, but not for the fruit. You offer your labor and the fruit of that labor to the Divine. Whatever the fruit, it is equal to you. This equality, spirit of equality, is first cultivated regarding the fruit of the work. Second, regarding the work itself. Many of us have a habit of developing attachment to the particular work we do, whether it is inertia, due to which we don't like to change over our work, or it is some vital satisfaction that we get in it. The fact remains that man gets attached to the work that he is doing. There are many ways of deluding oneself that it is not his choice. Maybe in the beginning, but afterward, there is a resistance in the nature for to change. This attachment to work, this preference for work has to be given up. Give up the fruits of work, give up also attachment to the work itself. Third, that the sense of the doer, that I am the worker, I am the doer, I am the instrument, that must go. It is in the ego center that this feeling persists. It gloats over the fact that it is the chosen instrument. This ego point has to be dissolved. One must realize that the real worker is the power of God. It is a universal power, individualized in places. It is that power which works through a million instruments, and each one of us is but one humble instrument with all our limitations. This sense of humility, awareness of our own imperfections and limitations, gratitude to the Divine for choosing us as His instruments, this has to become a life factor before the sense of equality becomes established. There are, as in consecration, even in the spirit of equality, there are three well-recognized stages. First is the stage of resignation, of endurance, of stoically facing whatever comes, whether blows of life, shocks, disappointments, successes, rejoicings, whatever it is. There is a stoic endurance, whether good or bad, happy or unhappy. The being presents an uncomplaining front. In the beginning it is stoical endurance. As it develops in the right spirit, it turns itself into a submission to the will of God. If it is thy will, I submit it to thee. I submit myself to thee. It is a resignation to the Divine will. The second stage is when one learns to withdraw from this movement of nature, events and happenings, and takes one's poise in the witness consciousness and regards what all passes with an eye of indifference. Sri Aurobindo calls it the philosophical stage, when the individual is not really affected by what passes, but watches from above. This is the interim stage. The third stage is when, by this separation from nature, as a result of constantly being poised nearer the uninvolved self, one opens to the peace, to the joy of the spirit, to the Divine will and knowledge and love. One feels an exhilaration. Even the very fact of living gives a sense of participation in the Divine's bliss of existence. This is the culmination of the movement of equality, when whatever the happenings, whatever the appearances, the being remains in that peace, touches the hem of the Divine's bliss. It goes without saying that if this sense of equality is to become real, one learns to recognize that there is one Divine, one God, one Spirit that is manifest in the universe. One does no, one no more shrinks, avoids or rejects anything in life because it is not pleasing to the eye, it does not answer to your requirements. Instead of repulsion, instead of rejection, one develops a sense of understanding. One knows that even in the ugly, even in the brutal, even in the cruel, some divine value, some divine power is trying to manifest. Mother said once that in the creation of God, everything is in its place. Even ugliness, even cruelty has a certain relevance to the person concerned in his particular stage of development. One recognizes with sympathy, with a charitable look, a sympathetic understanding, that persons are what they are, difficult they may be, because of the requirements of evolving nature in them. This understanding, based upon the perception of the equal pervasion of God everywhere, gives a certain release. Gives a certain release from individual reactions. The presence of God is not merely in forms, in creatures, but also in events. Events also, they have a before and an after. They may be unpalatable, they may be disappointing, but each event, each happening is a result of a past and a contribution to the future. The knack of spiritual life is to develop the eye of understanding, a conviction within that nothing is to be repelled, everything is to be helped to take its proper shape. There is a struggle going on everywhere in different forms of life. It is the concern of the enlightened, it is the concern of the awakened to lend whatever helpful thoughts, helpful emotions, helpful hand he can extend. When he sees nature, whether in himself or in others, acting in a confused manner, he knows that nature has three modes. It is still these three modes of nature, of inertia and darkness, of dynamism and life, movement, of light and peace. Till these three modes of nature find a certain harmony, each surpasses into the other, and all the three together are assumed in their divine counterparts, one has to have an understanding of the working of nature in its own mold. Till the lower nature is transmitted into the higher nature, friction, disharmony, suffering are inevitable. What these three modes of nature are, and why they move in the way they do, how they are perverted counterparts of the divine values, the divine modes of superior nature, will be the theme of our next talk. Any questions?
I'd like to ask a question about this person who had the experience. One of Mother's statements was, she may pray to Sri Aurobindo.
Or the Divine, yes.
And Sri Aurobindo says that he has set this up in such a way that the progress can be only through the Divine Mother. Can you give us some insights as to when to pray to Sri Aurobindo?
Actually, Mother can't say, pray to me. It is whether one prays to Mother or to Sri Aurobindo, it is the same. From my experience, from the experience of innumerable people, I can tell you that it is one being, one consciousness. Whether Sri Aurobindo himself wrote once, when you pray to me, when you write to me, it evokes response from the Mother. When you write to her, I respond. It does not matter to whom you write. Now, Mother has, I have observed, a very delicate sense of, you may say, propriety, and she wouldn't say, pray to me. So she gave a picture of Sri Aurobindo, she said. Now supposing she finds it difficult even to pray to Sri Aurobindo, she said, pray to the Divine. It all comes to the same thing. Because Sri Aurobindo and Mother are what they are to us, not as human individuals, but as embodiments of the Divine for us. For us, who have come to them as disciples, as devotees, they embody the Divine. This does not mean that these two forms exhaust the Divine for the whole universe. Those who seek the Divine through them, to them, they embody the Divine. So this person, being a little new to Mother, Mother has never said, pray to me. I have known. She said, you can pray, she will say. You can pray to Sri Aurobindo. Now, some have asked. I think I also have asked. But I can pray to you. She laughed. You see? She would never say, do this to me or ask me this. Think of the Divine. Offer your work to the Divine. Sri Aurobindo would write, offer your work to Mother in his letters. And those days when Sri Aurobindo was attending to correspondence, all of us used to write, rule was, we used to write to Mother, but the letters would be opened and answered by Sri Aurobindo. And after he answered, Mother would read them and write in her hand the address of the person and then send it to him. It was a way of expressing their joint working. Even now, when Mother deals with things, at times she says, Sri Aurobindo said this. She says, Sri Aurobindo says, even now.
I had once heard that Mother deals with us in a very personal way. The parts of the nature that are undergoing stress and aspiration for change. And that Sri Aurobindo's help was often of the universal and cosmic nature, where he would give the calm, when one prayed for the peace and the calm.
No, not that way. Even regarding the mother, he said, when she functions in her universal aspect, she does things in an impersonal way. But when she deals in her individualized aspect, she does things in a very personal way. Sri Aurobindo also, when he was dealing directly with people, he used to do things in a very personal way. Very personal, before the ashram formed. And even afterward, there are a few individuals with whom he had continued to have a personal relation. With them also he would deal in a personal way. Even a yogi, a developed yogi, has got both these ways of functioning. At a certain level, he can only be impersonal. He can only send waves of peace, bliss, dynamism. In the frontal level, he takes note of details, molds them, helps them, functions as a guru. So each one, because the divine has both the aspects, personal and impersonal, each man, because he is, after all, a self-formulation of the Divine, has also got the, both the aspects, personal and impersonal. As one develops in yoga, one can switch on from the personal level to the impersonal. There is a sense of liberation. There is a sense of wide embracing of the whole universe when that mood or when that poise takes over. One has to cultivate both. Most of us have to cultivate only the impersonal aspect because we are mostly lost in our personal things. It is the impersonal aspect, impersonal poise and status that has to be built up. Unless that is done, there cannot be liberation. Even the yoga of works, which is so individual, confined to worldly things, on its higher levels, it becomes perfect only when it touches the impersonal realms of equality, of peace, of self-surrender, when individuality is lost, when ego is exterminated. It is there one becomes more effective. Even in your day-to-day work, if you look back, if you look into yourself, you see. It is when you have a certain impersonal consciousness or some reflection of the impersonal in you that your work is self-effective, automatically right. There is a swing of the right movement. Everybody joins at the same time. That is when the impersonal set up in the occult realm concretizes itself on earth for however brief a period.
Chapter for today, Sri Aurobindo speaks of the misleading powers of darkness, whoever represent themselves as the one source of light and truth, and take on them a simulacrum of divine forms in order to capture the soul of the seeker.
Yes.
There has been a collective experience here in the Mahatma Mandir workers' camp. And in reference to the great value that this will build up in us during the daytime, these modes of salutation, the reverberation that will build, what about the nighttime? This collective experience was that of a nightmare, which was experienced not by one, but by a number of individuals. It was the same thing, a power, the experiencing of a power of darkness visiting, of being enveloped in a dark shape.
Yes.
Happened on the same night to various workers. What, is there something in us that opens to that? What is our defense during sleep? Immediately, during my experience, I called on Mother and the shape, the form vanished. But is there some protection before it happens to keep it out?
Yes, one sure method is, before one goes to sleep, one has to invoke the presence of the Mother, Sri Aurobindo, and entrust oneself in their hands. Meditate quietly with trust and slide into sleep in that pause. If you do that, you will see that at the first approach of something unpleasant, you will call Mother, and the whole thing scene changes. It may appear as if some thieves are coming to rob you. When thieves come, it means some dark forces, some nether forces are trying to rob you of what you have earned by your sadhana. It may be that some ferocious beings, dark beings, may come. But at the word, repetition of the word Mother, you can take it 100% they go. But that habit has to be developed in daytime also. To think of Mother, to call Mother at the first reaction, unhappy reaction, unhappy happening. And goes to other regions, where the encounters are not always pleasant. So if one remembers Mother, at that time it is automatic. One has to go into sleep in that poise, and you will see when you do that, that her consciousness, her protection is there. For those who can't do it, when her attention is drawn, she gives some physical token, a blessings packet, some physically concentrated item, which she asks to keep either on their bodies or below their pillows. That is done. Whichever way it is done, one has only to call her. It is just possible that some individuals may have either invited or opened themselves to these visitations. And in a close-knit community like this, it is very possible that the dark entities may have tried. But if Mother was informed, that would not continue.
Is it possible that Mata Mandir is a special mark for such visitation, such adverse forces and hostile beings?
But naturally, wherever the light is to manifest, wherever new things are to come, the old hostile elements are bound to try. But the opening will always come through some individuals.
the experience that Sunil talked about at night, I'm wondering if certainly the same occult worlds function all the time, but we may be more aware of them at night because we don't feel so subtle and don't have to deal with the body so much. But during the daytime, I'm asking if it's possible to be as aware of those kinds of actions and also be as aware of the danger as one is at night when one is having a dream in the body.
Actually, the balance of forces, the balance of things is different at night. There, at night, in dark, there is a preponderance of these dark elements, the forces and beings of darkness, occult darkness, they are more at night than during day. That is why during the day one is not, one doesn't encounter these things very much. Because even Sri Aurobindo has described in the essays in the Gita in one chapter, even physical light has a dip, different effect on these hostile entities. They recede. At night, they gain control. They try to gain control. Even man's vitality is low at night. So they try to take advantage of the lower functioning, the functioning of the life force at a lower level at night. These entities try to take advantage of it. That too, between, you may say, 11 and 3, it is the worst time when these forces and entities have a field day. Yes, I know what you mean. The lunar vibrations intensify a particular brand of dark forces, psychological, those of psychological illness, and also they create a magnetic field, so to say, for spirits, disembodied spirits, to come into play. Cases of lunacy, of erratic mind, they are affected by full moon. In what precise manner, I have not studied it, but it is true. Yes, yes, right.
As a mother, or have you read anything about the moon, its like significance? Because I remember when I took astronomy courses, he discussed that the moon is relative to the exact same size of the sun. So in other words, it's just in the right position between us and the sun, so that when you look at it, during an eclipse, it can totally block the sun out completely. And it's not, but it's exactly the same size. I mean, it's like such a freak chance thing that doesn't seem like it's really a chance to be that way. And it seems maybe the moon's role somehow is much more important than it just happened to be in orbit around the Earth. Have you ever read anything?
I have not read. I don't have special interest in the subject. Mother has not said anything on it. We meet next on 15.
Chapter 10.
Chapter 10. Three modes of nature, isn't
three
it?
Three modes of nature. But Mother asked about the meditation.
No, I'm not yet asked. I didn't feel
ready.
I didn't feel that way. So I think we will disperse.